Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Not everybody has the means or the time to do it, but sitting around the table for a proper family-style meal, complete with protein, vegetables, and dessert, is a long-standing American tradition. Or is it? When did how and what we eat become codified as right, proper, and essentially American? Abigail Carroll is a food historian and author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal, which explores the history of America's eating from the colonial era to the present. She joined Virginia last year to discuss her book.
And Abigail, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Virginia.
It's interesting that you use the term invention of the American meal. And one of the things that comes across is the way that most of us grew up in America eating three square meals a day is not a tradition, but a construct, an adaptation. Was that a surprise to you?
A little bit. I think, just like you said, we do tend to just think of the meal as unchanging, as static. But it's something that a lot of people have had their hands in, and each generation has reinvented. And as our circumstances have changed, so have our meals. I argue in the book that the shape of the meal really is in so many ways the shape of society. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that as society changes, so does the meal. But it hasn't just changed and evolved sort of naturally. It's also changed because we've wanted it to change. And we've had different ideas and different ways of defining the meal over time.
Talk a little bit about the evolution of American eating back to the colonial period. A lot of detail we get on the diets of working people and the landed gentry, which ate very differently from each other.
That's right. In the very early colonial days, for the most part, people were eating a hot meal in the middle of the day, and that's the meal that they called dinner. And they were rising early. They were eating a sort of ad hoc breakfast and an ad hoc supper, which is to say perhaps leftovers from dinner, perhaps heated, but perhaps not, perhaps with others, perhaps alone. Breakfast and supper were very much like glorified snacks. And the dinner often came out of a single pot. You had often one pot meals. And people were not gathering around a table for dinner and putting on their best manners and catching up about each other's day, because they were often working together on a farm or in a family business, and they didn't have to catch up with each other. And, they were eating very rustically. It was a while before the fork appeared. And for many years, you know, bread was doing the work of the spoon in terms of sopping up juices and whatnot. People often just put a board across two trestles and brought up a bench, some wooden crates, or simply, you know, squatted or leaned against the wall in the very early days if there wasn't enough chairs for everyone. So the meal looked very different in those days. But it changed quite drastically during the Industrial Revolution.
How did that change? When people moved off the land, obviously not working side by side with each other necessarily in the family anymore, what happened to meals then?
Well, people had to accommodate changing work schedules. You know, they were leaving the farms for factories. They were leaving the country for the city. They were working farther from where they lived, and they couldn't necessarily return home in the middle of the day for a hot meal. And even if they could, you know, if they were working in an office or at a desk, a hot meal would have probably done them in for the rest of the day, such as a farmer's dinner. And so they shifted dinner to the evening, when it became really a social time. This is when dinner became special, because the evening was special. It was the time that the family had together, having been separated now during the day. Dinner also changed from a one-pot meal to, in the 1700s, a kind of pudding and roast type of a meal. And in the 19th century, in the Victorian era, it became a French-inspired meal, which is to say not only French-inspired foods, but perhaps even more importantly, courses. People were starting, with soup. They were ending with dessert. They might have a green salad after their entree. And so dinner looked a lot different then than it had in the colonial period.
You spend a couple of chapters on the rise of dinner to a place of primacy in most of our families and diets. It's come to symbolize a great deal, family unity for one thing, but you give some data on the role it serves even in educating families. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. You know, children were not necessarily expected to participate in, you know, dinner time conversation at the table. In the colonial era, there just wasn't a lot of conversation to be had necessarily to begin with. But during the Victorian era, with the emergence of the middle class, this is when families really celebrated formality and etiquette and manners, and they taught their children not to put their elbows on the table, etc. And, you know, children were being trained in what it meant to be middle class, what it meant to be respectable, so that when they grew up and attended a formal dinner party, which was very popular during this era, they would know how to hold their own and they would come across as proper and respectable. And so they trained them, you know, in manners, but part of that was just simply how to hold a conversation.
We're speaking with Abigail Carroll. She's a food historian. She's written for several publications like the New York Times and has taught at BU. She's the author of the new book, Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. We have this idea that traditional rituals like the evening meal have been thrown aside by contemporary life. Everybody sitting down together is this idea we have, but it's not true. I mean, people, you pointed out people didn't always sit at tables. And you also write about the stander-uppers, you know, people who ate standing up and ate separately in many families.
Yeah, well, think about fast food. The origins of fast food are really the quick lunch. So very late 19th century and early 20th century, this is when you have people working in cities, at factories, and lunch has really come to fill in that gap now between breakfast and dinner when, you know, dinner shifted to the evening. And because dinner was so special, lunch didn't have to be. And so lunch was really this stopgap meal. It was emphasis on quick, on often cold, although not always, and cheap. But quick was really the big thing. And that was, of course, so that you could get right back to work and that you could be productive and that you could be profitable. And so the quick lunch venue emerges. This is when cafeterias emerge and eventually automats where, you know, you can just drop a coin in a slot, open a door, take out your pie, drop another coin in another slot, open the door, retrieve a coffee, and the idea of eating in 20 minutes or 15, and in some cases five, not even sitting down. Many of these places didn't even have tables. They had chairs. Think about a classroom where you have the sort of desk as part of the chair as one unit. Well, they had these what they called one-armed joints. A one-armed joint was a restaurant that you would go to where you could grab your food cafeteria style, bring it to a chair that had a wraparound table, a little depression for your coffee cup, and you could wolf it down without the, you know, need to socialize or waste time talking with anybody.
Why cereal, eggs, and pancakes for breakfast, but never for lunch or dinner?
Well, breakfast used to be one of those meals where it didn't matter what you ate. There weren't specific foods you associated just with breakfast. You had leftovers for breakfast. And in the 1800s, you often had a breakfast that looked a lot more like dinner because meat became very central to breakfast. And you might have porridge with your meat or breakfast cakes such as muffins or biscuits. But in the mid to late 19th century, with the Industrial Revolution and the change in lifestyles, people couldn't eat that farmer's breakfast anymore because it just made for a bad case of indigestion. And so this is when health reformers such as Sylvester Graham and later John Harvey Kellogg were experimenting with the farinaceous breakfast, which is to say the grain-based breakfast. And breakfast cereal is invented at sanitariums where people went to seek health from various maladies, namely indigestion. And then breakfast cereal colonizes a meal and becomes iconic of that meal.
Well, of course, the history of how we eat in America is never far from how food has been marketed in America. What are some other places where good old entrepreneurial opportunism played into the invention of the American meal?
Well, the first thing, of course, that comes to mind is breakfast cereal. Of course, with snacking, that's really where entrepreneurialism comes in. You have people who are initially just peddling snack foods on the streets, pretzel peddlers and peanut peddlers, and people selling popcorn at fairs and circuses and political rallies. And this was a way that a lot of immigrants, you know, made it. They were dirt poor, but they made it in this country, in the New World, by selling perhaps a food that they brought with them, such as the pretzel being brought from Germany. But then many of them went into business. I think of the two brothers, immigrants from Germany, who started Cracker Jack in Chicago in the late 1800s. And they were the first, really, to take a snack food and process it, basically manufacture it, you know, manufacture it on an industrial scale, and put it in a box. And when they put it in a box, it just took on new characteristics. One of the things that happened when they put it in a box was that it was seen as cleaner, purer, and basically less suspicious, because snack food had become stigmatized as being associated with rather unhygienic, dirt-poor immigrants with different cultural standards, and perhaps because of their different cultural standards, different health standards and hygienic standards. So snack food becomes really just a very fertile area for food entrepreneurs.
Mm. It's now a multi-billion dollar industry, and something that you were looking into, researching originally, when you started this book. I understand that you were looking into snacking and the connection with obesity. And I'm wondering about this. Now we know so much more about metabolism, how we process food. There are a lot of recommendations for people to eat a number of smaller meals or graze throughout the day. Talk to me about how the American meal is evolving now.
The meal and the snack have, since the Victorian era, they've had a bit of a contentious relationship. And if you look at studies that have been done just in the past decade or so, you'll see that, you know, we are consuming more calories than we have in the past. But children's intake right now, the gain in calories from meals have not kept up with the gain in calorie from snacks, which is to say that the snack is displacing the meal calorically. And so that's another sort of challenge to the family meal, is the rise of snacking and snack food.
Well, Abigail, you're a food historian. This obviously isn't the first time that you've considered what you're eating. But I wonder, after writing this book and looking at the specifics of how meals have been shaped, but also how they influence our culture, I'm wondering, when you sit down to eat, what are you thinking about?
I think about how little we think about the meal, and how entrenched our eating patterns are, and how entrenched our sense of what we think we should eat is. You know, when I say that I have soup for breakfast perhaps one day, I think it's very, very jarring for people, and very rare to come across somebody who would eat for breakfast something that's not considered a standard breakfast food. And this is, you know, not the case throughout the world. Not everybody eats quote unquote breakfast foods for breakfast, but I've seen just how deep those roots are.
Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Virginia.
Abigail Carroll is the author of Three Squares, The Invention of the American Meal. You can find a link to read an excerpt from the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Cigarettes and chocolate milk. These are just a couple of my cravings.
The one place you probably don't want to visit if you're embarking on a new diet in the new year is the all-you-can-eat buffet. With its dizzying array of choices, the ability to choose a healthy option can pose a challenge even for those with an iron will. Up next, we'll speak to a researcher who's cracked the code and found a way to improve diners' decision-making skills when they hit the buffet. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Everything it seems I like's a little bit sweet.